and welcome to a very special episode of Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. A birthday edition. Nope, it's not my birthday, although it was on Monday. It's this podcast's birthday. It's actually crazy to think that this month marks 2 years since the podcast began. And in that time, we've heard over 50 individuals. All of those people have overcome something extraordinary. Some are still on their journey, whether it's been a story of addiction, abuse, of mental health struggle, or of someone going above and beyond to help others. Every single story has certainly left me feeling inspired, and hopefully it's done the same for you as well. With it being 2 years, though, since we started telling these incredible stories, it felt right to take a look back. And I think in current circumstances, you know, it's a really tough time for all of us, and we could all do with a little bit of inspiration. So I've picked out some moments from those last 2 years, the moments that left me feeling uplifted and motivated. And if that sounds like something that you could do with right now, stay right here. In this episode, we'll be hearing from retired athlete Dame Jessica Ennis-Hill, Manchester bombing survivor Freya Lewis, Busted's Matt Willis, and TV chef Nadia Hussein, MBE. I was wondering, actually, back in the days of school days and, you know, before you were the Jessica Ennis that we knew, who was it that kind of inspired you onto this path? Because you're an inspiration for not just women, a lot of men as well. Were there kind of key people that inspired you to become the person we know?
Yeah, I think more than anyone, it was my parents, to be honest. They, you know, they introduced me to athletics, and they were the ones who took me to training camps and drove me around the country to different competitions. My grandparents were a massive part in, you know, helping fund my athletics and, and, you know, get me to training after school and all those little things that, you know, we'll end up doing in a few years' time with our kids, which is so important. And then I met my coach, Tony Minicello, and he kind of took things from there, you know, nurturing me as a young athlete, teaching me the event.
Were your parents sporty themselves then? Did they have that background?
Not really, no. They both did school sport, and my dad was a bit of a sprinter. I think my mum did high jump a bit, but nothing. There's no one in the family that have been, you know, really sporty.
So they must be very proud of all your achievements then.
Yeah, I think they still, I know if we talk about it, they're still just kind of a bit shocked like I am. You know, they just had, you know, two daughters. They sent us off to like a summer camp at the athletics club in Sheffield, and my mum just remembers a coach coming up saying, oh, she, you know, Jess is a really good runner, you should sign her up to the club. And my mum just thought, yeah, you know, she enjoys it. You know, I never thought that anything would really come of it. And then years went by and I started picking up medals at school level, Yorkshire Championships, North of England, and then it all progressed to Europeans, Worlds, Olympic titles, and it just incredible, really. So my mum would always say, you know, keep doing your athletics. If you're enjoying it, keep doing it, but don't, you know, don't forget about your school stuff. And yeah, I just wanted to go to university. I wanted to have something else in my locker. I wanted to have a bit of a backup plan, because sport can be so fragile, and you can be an amazing athlete at the top of your game and it could all change in an instant. Mm-hmm. So I think I always had that feeling of it could all end really quickly.
Mm. So do you think it helped you when you had that injury, having studied psychology? Because I guess a lot of that is in, not necessarily in the mind, but the psychology of how you deal with it. And how you reframe it, and how you look at failures and success.
Yeah, definitely. I think I've always been really fascinated with psychology and human behaviour and how we view things and how we act. It's always something that's really fascinated me, and that's why I wanted to study psychology. So although it wasn't a specific sports psychology degree, it was a general psychology degree, I still feel that I learned certain things within my degree that I could apply to being an athlete. And I think, yeah, it gave me, definitely gave me a lot of mental toughness. And I think that's been one thing that I've been able to have throughout my career that's allowed me to go on to achieve what I did, just having that mental strength.
And I wonder, I mean, a lot of the people that listen to this podcast are people that are coming to it for support on mental health, advice on confidence, anxiety. And I was thinking about how I could talk to you about that. And then I thought, well, back to that summer of 2012, all our eyes were on you. You know, it was like not just this country, the world, you know. And you'd have to be very robust and confident. And, you know, how do you get to be that person? And how do you cope with that amount of pressure?
Yeah, I think it's so easy for me now to sit here and be like, yeah, I loved every minute of it. It was great. Mm. It was, you know, the best time of my life. But if I actually take myself back to that time, it was hard because I
was nervous for you.
Yeah, it was so much pressure. And I think I put so much pressure on myself because I was like, this is like a once in a lifetime opportunity. I'm never going to have this again. I don't want it to go wrong.
Yeah.
But equally, everybody else expected me to win. And if I'd come away with a silver medal, that would have been an absolute failure.
Yeah, which is crazy to say,
medal.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So it was really, really strange time. But I think having that consistency of great people around me, my family, my team, all those consistent people that have been around me for the years leading into the London Olympics, they helped me so much and they gave me perspective. And my coach would say to me, it's just another heptathlon. You know, you're competing against the same girls. You've done all the training. So when I stepped out onto the track, I did have confidence because I just told myself, I've done this so many times.
Can do it.
I've done training that is much harder than what I'm going to have to do now. I'm ready for it. And just do it.
So do you think you approach things in your life with a kind of failure's not an option approach?
I don't think about it. I just don't let my mind even wander into that. And I know that can be so hard. And, you know, it's very easy to try and think positive and then you start drifting off to the negatives that could happen. But I literally did not even let myself think, all those people are watching.
Right.
What if I fall over?
Come in your headspace.
What? Because I think if you start thinking all those negative thoughts, they can become a reality.
Yeah. So you really believe in that? It kind of encroaches.
Absolutely. I think that if I had lined up for the hurdles and in the back of my mind I was thinking, oh, what if I fall over the first hurdle? I probably would have fallen over the first hurdle because it's in there. Mm-hmm. I planted that seed. Whereas I stepped upon that line and I was like, I'm going to blast out of these blocks harder than I've ever blasted out of them. I'm going to attack every hurdle. And that's all I thought about. It wasn't about
falling. So do you believe in that visualization then?
Yeah, massively. Yeah. I think you can take it into every part of your life. Mm. I think that if you visualize, you know, a perfect outcome and you keep thinking about it and telling your mind that, then I think it really helps in making it physical.
It's interesting because I was 24, so I, you know, I was an adult compared to you being 14, but I still look back now and think I haven't really led a normal life for somebody of that age. And I look at other people of my age and what they were doing with, you know, whilst they were, I don't know, getting engaged, getting mortgages, I was learning to walk, to swallow, having physio. Do you ever think about your life that you've had to grow up so quickly and you're different to other 17-year-olds?
Yeah, definitely. It's so weird to think of life before the 22nd of May because it almost feels like that was a completely different person because it feels like such a long time ago and like I'm now used to what has happened and what I look like and everything now.
Who were you before, if you had to describe yourself?
I was crazy, really immature, 14-year-old that was just happy all the time. And I was actually going through, it's kind of contradicting what I just said, but I was going through some really bad friendship issues when I was 14. And I was literally, I became separated from all my friends. Mm-hmm. And I was by myself every day at school. So it was just awful. But especially now after the 22nd of May, you know, as soon as it happened, we all kind of came together.
That's positive.
And just I've now kind of realised that, you know, like petty fights that like 14-year-old girls have in high school do not mean anything. And they're just, but I do feel like a different person now. And I think probably the way I present myself at college and things, people just think I am a normal 17-year-old. Mm-hmm. But it's so
until
much
they talk
different.
To you because you're so mature. Is it something you tell people or do you keep it confidential?
It It depends on, so everyone, obviously at my high school knew, as soon as I went back, everyone knew who mm-hmm. I was that girl. But I went to a new college in September. So that was, I was really scared to go in. But as soon as I went in, it was only my friends that knew, which felt really nice to have a fresh start and to just be known as a normal person again, which was what yeah. I was known as before the 22nd of May. But there have definitely been times because I've, you know, like made new friends and stuff, which I have to tell, but I feel like there has definitely been a point that it has to get to before I tell people, because yeah. I don't want to like sit down in a classroom and then they're like, hi, I'm so-and-so. And I'm like, hi, I'm a terrorist attack victim. Cause that yeah. usually would scare people off. The main thing for me, it makes me happy when people don't act weird around me and get awkward. Mm-hmm. I hate that. If people just go, oh, that's awful, but you're a normal person at the end of the day, then that's what I like, which yeah. is still, especially on like different days, whether it's like the anniversary or something like that, people are still conscious of me and get a bit scared to say things. I like telling people because that's my life. That's me. And it always will be a part of me. So I think wherever I go in life, I'll still be like, hi, I'm Freya, and this is my story, just because I like being strong and saying that. So I hope that's what I do for the rest of my life.
Do you feel like it's brought out different characteristics in your personality?
Definitely. I was just, not that I'm incredibly confident now, but I was really shy before the 22nd of May. But now that's not me. And even though this horrendous thing has happened to me, I'm less nervous and less anxious and scared of things. Like even going to London and we're on the tube, sometimes that has been, it does scare me a little bit. But I think it was a couple years ago, my dad, we got out of the tube and I was with my family, and my dad said, oh, you coped really well, because that was the first time I went into that sort of crowd and public space. And then that's, I was like, tough. Oh, I'm fine. So I think I said to him, oh, well, I've taken one for the team and I've already been in this horrific event, so the chances mm-hmm. of me being in another one is quite little. So my dad was just a bit shocked and was like, oh, okay. Yeah.
But to have that perspective and that view at any age after what you've been through is quite incredible. It's quite remarkable. You know, where does that come from? How do you get to that place?
I don't know. I think it just, like I said, I think it will always come back to my family. They've always encouraged me to be like that. Like I said, my dad's got an awful dark sense of humour that I used to hate before the 22nd of May, but straight on, we all adopted it and we all make jokes every single day about it. So mm-hmm. they always encouraged me to not look at it as this negative thing and, mm-hmm. you know, to look at it as something that I can tell people and hopefully inspire people. And that's just the way I view it. I don't know. And people like, even like Ariana Grande, the way that she's just got on with things and gone mm-hmm. on and done more world tours and things like that, that's shown me that I shouldn't be afraid and I shouldn't live in fear and I should just continue being as happy as I was before the 22nd of May.
Also from Something Else.
How did we get here? With Claudia Winkleman and Professor Tanya Byron. In these in-depth, one-on-one therapy sessions, we dig deep into personal stories with fascinating and emotional revelations. A passionate, insightful, and moving experience with clear outcomes to each episode.
He is as anxious about attachment with you as you are with him.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. That's crazy, isn't it? Oh, that's a weird feeling. Wait, so... God, don't you just feel like, whoa, why didn't I know that all along?
Listen now in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all good podcast apps.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered, but we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
You may have heard of the podcast Juicy Scoop. Wondered what it is? Why aren't you listening? Well, I'm its host, created it, been doing it for 7 years. I'm Heather McDonald of Juicy Scoop with Heather McDonald. Now, I could tell you why you should be listening to my show, but my listeners wanted to write the ad for me, and here are some of the things they said. Not your regular Juicy podcast. Catch up on all the juicy topics from Hollywood and pop culture to true crime and beyond. Heather McDonald's Juicy Scoop always has great guests, great laughs, and great gossip. It's a comedian's take on the hottest headlines. Juicy Scoop is the pop culture news you want to hear. No BS, no filter, no filler. Raw, real, and in the moment. Throw in the hilarity of amazing comedians that you will instantly be obsessed with, a juicy crime story, and a dash of normal life in LA moments, and you've got yourself an amazing week of Juicy Scoop. Two episodes every week, every Tuesday and Thursday. It will never let you down.
You've been famous your whole adult life. You don't know not being famous as an adult.
I don't know if I'd really call myself famous anymore. Like, it's kind of it's a very, I don't know. That's a weird term, isn't it? It's like when when Busted was even at its peak, I'd say I was only famous to a certain category of person. Like, unless you're a Busted fan, Right. Friends of my mum wouldn't know who I was, you know, but if you were a teenager, you know, you'd know who I was, you know. So I just knew not to go to shopping malls on a Saturday, or don't ever go to a bowling alley, you know, a certain places like you just can't really go to, you know. But most of the time I could kind of get away with kind of, you know, and things like concerts and things were a struggle and certain other things like that. But apart from that, I could kind of hang out with my mates and kind of live a sort of normalish life at times, you know. Only really did I really notice what kind of crazy fame was, I suppose, when I did The Jungle, because then, like, suddenly going from a targeted audience, you know, don't get me wrong, when Busted were on tour, you know, like, everywhere we went was pretty chaotic, but then coming out of The Jungle, like, you kind of get into a cab and everyone is like, hello, Matt. You're like, oh, God, yeah. Or you go into the post office and the guy behind the counter knows who you are and knows something about you, which was a very strange, strange change of pace.
Was it hard? Because, like you said, although you did have that fame, you still had some anonymity. Is that how you say it?
Anonymity.
That's it. So you did have that. And like you said, going in The Jungle, it's all backgrounds and ages that watch that. Was it a bit intrusive when you came out?
I kind of look back at that as a very weird moment in my life, because it was kind of a time in my life where I didn't really know what I was doing, you know. Like, before then, I kind of always kind of, like, I'd been in a band since I was, before then I was at school and I wanted to be an actor. Then I wrote some songs with my friend, and then I was in a band, and that was all I did, you know, and that was all I ever wanted to do at that time. And then that ended, and I'm a Celebrity kind of happened in this kind of period where I was like, I don't really know who I am, what I'm doing. I'm 21 and everything.
Still so young.
Still kind of young. Yeah. Not really having any kind of, like, I'd never really had a life plan or kind of, like, everything. It's kind of a weird thing to say, but everything I'd ever thought about wanting to achieve, I'd achieved, you know. So I kind of felt like I was kind of at this place where, like, I don't really know what to do now. Yeah,
I wondered, going on something like that and sort of being essentially your authentic self, and then that working out for you, you know, you won, people got behind you, they liked you. Like, this is an industry where you can't always be your authentic self. And it's also an industry full of rejections that aren't really based on fact. You know, people reject people for lots of different reasons, and it can sometimes affect your self-worth. And I just wondered what the experience was like of opening up, being authentic, and people being like, yeah, I like that, and you're going to win. You know, was it quite reassuring?
When I think back on it now, I think about it in that way. At the time, it just felt like this crazy whirlwind of stuff that was happening, and I wasn't really in a very good headspace. You know, like, I was kind of in quite a self-destructive point in my life. And it's one of those things.
Why do you think that was?
I kind of always had a problem with drink and drugs and that kind of world. And it was really kind of starting to take a grip of me at that moment in my life. And, And kind of when I came out of the show, it really, I was up and running, you know, and it was kind of, and that was a moment where it was kind of getting to a point where it was time to address that demon, you know, and it was kind of, so to be honest, I came out of the show and just lost the plot for about a year. You know, so I didn't really,
Why? Because of too much opportunity? Or?
No, I think I was just ready to do that at that point in my life. You know, it was kind of coming for a while, and I kind of, and I wasn't really ready to address certain demons at that point and kind of put certain things down. I was just kind of in it, and I was very, you know, and I had a very low self-worth, you know, I kind of felt like, I'd always kind of struggled with that. And so I couldn't really...
Why do you think you had a low self-worth?
You know, I have no idea. I've kind of addressed that or looked at that quite a lot in my life, that kind of feeling of kind of low, kind of self-loathing and kind of that kind of stuff, which kind of fuels alcoholism in me and certain other things. And I kind of had to kind of, at certain moments in recovery, just go, do you know what? You might have to just understand that you're not going to really know the answers. You know, you just have to understand that this demon is part of you and this person is within you, and you just have to kind of manage that in a certain way, you know? And so I have to implement certain things in my life and kind of do things a certain way to be able to navigate that.
Because society's always sort of obsessed with the exterior and, you know, wrongly not sympathetic with people that they believe on the exterior has everything. So whether it's being good looking, whether it's being wealthy, whether it's, you know, having a career other people envy, and people can't understand why internally your thoughts wouldn't reflect the level of joy that it seems. But often it's people in that position that are more tortured. Did you attach a guilt to it, to not feeling good? Because, you know, yeah, you had these ambitions from a young age to be this person.
Yeah, you're so right. Like, I think it comes with a lot of imposter syndrome as well. Like, it kind of comes from that place of kind of like, at any moment you're going to get found out and everyone's going to know that you're not really meant to be what you are. And, you know, like, who are you kidding? You don't deserve this and all this kind of stuff, which kind of... So it's funny. I've talked to a lot of people, especially actors, who have this too, you know, right. Like these people who are like, I'm like, what are you talking about? You're this guy who's amazing, you know, but they still have this in them. And it's kind of, and so it's, you know, it kind of goes everywhere, I think.
Do you believe in, you know, when people refer to having an addictive personality, do you think that's a thing?
I don't know. I know I have it. You know, I don't know. I mean, yes, it is a thing because, is it a thing? I don't know. I'm an addict. I know I am. I tick every box. If there's if there's something you can take too far, I have either already taken it too far or I'm in the process of doing so. You know, so kind of like if there's you know, I find that I kind of put one down and pick one up, you know, and that's something which I'm really trying to be better at and kind of noticing these kind of warning signs because, you know, it's, and to be honest, it's not even about, like, I don't drink or take drugs anymore, you know, but like...
You can't socially drink that you're teetotal.
Oh, no, I haven't had a drink for over 10 years, but like but that doesn't mean that I haven't had this impact my life in other ways. You know, like it can come into play with anything I do. And it's just, for me now, it's more about behavior. It's more about the way I behave and the way I see myself behaving about certain things. I'm like, that's, got to watch that. Got to be careful of that. Because before I know it, that can slip into the way I think about myself. And it can be a negative kind of spiral because of an action which was not beneficial. And so when I look back at these things, when I look back at who I am, you know, I'm like, would I take this away? Would my life be better without it? You know, and I don't know. I don't know if I'd be who I am, you know, like, I mean, I worry that I'm passing things on subconsciously to my children. I'm like, oh my God, you know, because I grew up around certain things and I saw certain things and I absorbed certain things from people around me. I'm like, you know, mm-hmm. but I'm a very different person to the person I was 10 years ago. So I'm hoping that I'm passing on a different message.
Before I'd won Bake Off, I was a stay-at-home mum. And so often, as a stay-at-home mum, I'd be really nervous to say the words, I'd say, I'm just a mum. People would say, what do you do? And I'd say, I'm just a mum. And
I hate full-time career.
Yeah, and I hate that word just, because there is nothing just about being a mum. Because it's, you know, you don't get any holiday pay, you get no holidays, you know, there's no clocking off time, you are on it. Yeah. All the, as you know what it's like. You've got two quite young kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And you are literally on it all the time. And mm-hmm. Mine are 12 and 13. My boys are 12 and 13, right. And my little girl will be 9 soon. And somebody said to me, the older they get, you know, the less they need you. That's a lie.
Good, because I don't want that to happen. No. I'll be sad if that happens.
Yeah, they need you even more. Even now, my 13-year-old, as I leave, he says, oh, I don't want you to go. And even now at 13, yeah. he kind of holds on. And I want him to hold on for as long as possible.
But that sounds like a beautiful, close relationship, though. That sounds the dream, really.
Yeah. I suppose it's one... I grew up in a community where, you know, emotions and feelings, they're not something that you didn't talk about it. And I say it's something in my community, but I think there's something quite British about being...
I was going to say, yeah, absolutely.
About, you know, the whole keep calm and carry on.
Mm-hmm. Stiff upper lip.
And I grew up in a culture that you didn't talk about feelings, you didn't talk about emotions, you just got on with it. And I want to be the complete opposite. I want to talk about everything. I want to talk about every feeling.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, if you grew up like that and that was kind of what was sort of the message that was sent down to you, you know, you've done a really brave thing with your documentary recently, your BBC documentary about anxiety. You know, that was talking about feelings and emotions and not hiding anything. That was amazing.
I've never felt more naked.
I can imagine.
Than in that situation. And when I was not very good at being honest with my children about my anxiety, and it was the first time that they would see, they asked me whenever I'm filming something, like, Mummy, what are you filming? And when I wouldn't come home at night with cake and biscuits and stuff, they're like, she's doing something different. They knew. Mm-hmm. Like 3 days in, they were like, why have you got no food back? Mm-hmm. And I just said, this is nothing to do with food.
Do you think they knew what the word anxiety meant before the doc?
They knew vaguely what it meant. And we talk about feelings quite a lot. And rather than saying anxiety or, you know, we didn't necessarily use the word anxiety or panic disorder or PTSD, things like that. Mm-hmm. But now, since watching the documentary, they sort of understand those words better, because, you know, I didn't expect to come out of there being diagnosed with PTSD.
Right. Yeah.
And I was shocked myself. So it was something that I had to then explain to the kids.
But did they watch the doc with you, like sat next to you?
Yeah. So we had access to it before it was out. And so I let them sit down and watch it, and they did. And then when it was aired, they watched it again. And I remember them, there was a sense of pity.
Right.
And they kind of looked at me and they said, oh, you know, I could see it in their eyes. You know, they didn't say the words, but I could see it. You know,
their empathy
you just see it. And I was like, oh my goodness.
Well, they've seen your struggle.
Yeah.
And your mum that holds it together all the time.
I try so hard to hold it together. And that's something I learned about myself, is that actually there's nothing... I think you're a better parent for being vulnerable, for allowing your kids to see emotions that are totally normal, to be able to say, you know what, I'm not okay today. Mm-hmm. And I feel sad. And you know, we help each other. And I think as a parent, what you want to do is you want to be the one that helps them all the time. And we don't want to lean on our kids. But as a family unit, we lean on each other.
Yeah, I suppose it's your instincts that think that's not right. But actually, it's impossible for one person to be the kind of core of everything.
Yeah, just holding it together all the time felt really, really hard. And then when they watched it, I could see it in their eyes, and I didn't want to look at them because they were just, I could see pity.
Yeah.
And I felt really sorry for them.
Was it hard to watch the programme back itself? Because you've done so many different TV series, TV shows, some lighthearted, some funny, some fascinating. And then this was quite different. You know, what was it?
it's a bit different than sitting around the telly with snacks and watching a programme you made, you know?
I mean, this wasn't a kind of popcorn type situation. Yeah. let's get the popcorn. No, it was more, I kind of sat there kind of scratching my hands and with a box of tissues. Mm. And it was hard to watch. And it was really odd because I'd come back and talk about it with my husband and I mm-hmm. filmed for about 2.5 weeks. And I felt like my husband knew everything that I was doing. And then he obviously had to sit and watch it himself and he hadn't realised. I mean, there's lots of things. Everything on there is stuff that he already knew, but to actually watch it
firsthand, yeah.
He struggled with that a little bit as well. And I think he definitely has a better understanding of anxiety now mm-hmm. than he did before watching it. But he's already, I mean, generally he's a good guy and he tries really hard to
yeah.
to get it and hold it together and make sure that I'm okay. But now he gets it. He's like, I get it. And I think when I watch it back, I remember the struggle of filming that. But mm-hmm. I also understand the importance of filming it because yeah. I know there'll be loads of people who will sit there and don't understand it or may not have anxiety themselves, but know somebody who has it. Or
and then it makes sense. Yeah.
And then it makes sense. And I think if I hadn't been completely honest, it would have been a half-hearted documentary and I didn't want it to be that.
Yeah, like it's actually a resource. You know, it's not just you talking about your life. It's a resource for, like you said, other people or people unknowingly supporting people.
Yeah.
Your husband kind of sounds like he's been your biggest cheerleader in your life. I mean, when I was reading about you and your journey before Bake Off, it was your husband that sort of pushed you to enter. Is that right?
Yeah, he was. Oh, he's such a gem, he is. And I can't, like, I don't want to be the wife that sits there and like sits there and says, oh yeah, my husband did this. And he's just great. I'm the worst friend or sister to have around because I have nothing bad to say. Yeah. I just don't because.
But that's good. That's positive. I love that.
And we shouldn't be like, we should be proud of a marriage that, you know, mm-hmm. we should be proud of that. And it works for us. And he's my best friend. And, you know, and in the last 4 years, I've lost many relationships mm-hmm. because of what I do and he's always been there. And this is long before Bake Off. You know, he's the only one that I could truly explain how I was feeling. And he never always got it. But, you know, we got to a point where he was just like, I think I get it. And he understands me.
Yeah. Which is, like you said, it's very difficult to find somebody that understands you. And it's what we all search for. It's the ultimate kind of quest.
Yeah.
Has it been difficult because life's changed so much for people around you to change with you?
Yeah, I think there's lots of people who are just never, you know, I've lost lots of people, lots of friendships and mm-hmm. lots of family members, but...
Through jealousy or misunderstanding?
I think it's partly misunderstanding, you know, there might be jealousy involved. I don't know. I just think that, I think the thing with women, firstly, is that women sometimes don't always like to see other women succeed.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of that. And I think that's why it's really hard sometimes because in the last 4 years, I've changed so much and I've found myself in a way that I didn't think there's so much of me was lost in the first sort of 8 years, 8-9 years, because being a mother, being a stay-at-home mom and focusing just on one thing mm-hmm. meant that I didn't focus on myself anymore. And I felt selfish for it. And I felt cruel for wanting to focus on myself. It felt unkind. I thought, I've brought these children into the world. They should be my everything. But they can truly only be my everything if I love myself first.
And if you have yourself, I mean, if you don't have any identity, then who are you?
And I'd lost myself. Mm. I was gone. There was nothing there. And I loved my kids. I love my children. And I was just existing. Mm-hmm. And it didn't feel okay to just exist because I was so crippled with my anxiety that it was my husband who said, you need to enter Bake Off. And I was like, what?
And were you cooking at this point at home?
I'm like, when I'm stressed, I cook more.
I see this on your Instagram. Yeah. I'm like, wow, look at all this stuff she's cooking. This is amazing.
I just keep going.
Yeah.
And when I'm really stressed, I bake and I bake and I bake. Mm-hmm. And I have like 2 or 3 cake stands around the house. And my husband's like, you know, you don't have to put cake in them. I'm like, then what are cake stands for?
Yeah.
And I will just fill them. And then I'll go to the neighbours. And the neighbours know when I'm anxious because mm-hmm. I'll turn up with like yesterday I was at my neighbor's house. I had lemon drizzle and a vegetable pie. Mm-hmm. And I just went over. He's like, are you all right? And I was like, I've just been baking. Leave me alone.
But maybe this is positive because the baking's a form of therapy. And then it's making you leave the house and connect with people to give them the food. And actually, when you talk about getting better, it's all about connecting with others, isn't it? So I guess that kind of pushes you to leave the house that day.
Yeah. And just doing Bake Off was the hardest thing I'd ever done. And mm-hmm. it's the first time I'd done, I had lots of firsts. So right. it's the first time I'd been on a train on my own without my children.
That's hard.
Yeah. And you know, and it wasn't a simple journey. It was like five changes. Mm-hmm. So it was
stressful
and sweaty, and it was hideous. I vomited.
Yeah,
it was horrible. And I realized, you know, I was using lots of safety seeking behaviors. I was like looking down, not making eye contact.
On your phone.
Or, yeah. Just avoiding any human contact, any interaction. And it was the best thing I did. It was the hardest thing. Mm. One of the hardest things I'd ever done, but it's changed my life.
Thank you for listening to this special episode of Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. The guests you heard from there were Dame Jessica Ennis-Hill, Freya Lewis, Matt Willis, and Nadia Hussain. And you can hear the full episodes along with loads more on all podcast platforms.